from the Seriously Sweet studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another tasty hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Raspberries are usually considered strictly northern crops. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal how you can grow these sweet treats in warm weather climes. Plus, the founder of the legendary Wood Prairie Farm talks about a new potato from France that growers are raving about. And of course, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and chronically contrite conciliations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens, because it's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Forever Studios of DIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another I Don't Want to Know That hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we present a terrifying Time magazine story by Jeffrey Kluger about our food and water. And we quote, on November 18th, the Environmental Protection Agency approved the use of the pesticide isocyclid on golf courses and lawns, as well as peas and beans, tomatoes, oranges, almonds, and more. The particular problem with these pesticides is that they contain PFAS, P-F-A-S, forever chemicals that linger in the environment. According to a 2020 study in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, PFAS are present in the blood of 98% of all Americans. PFAS have been linked to decreased fertility, certain cancers, especially kidney cancer, developmental delays in children, hormonal irregularities, elevated cholesterol, reduced effectiveness of your immune system, and more. This approval is part of a larger pattern by the Trump administration to broaden the use of PFAS-containing pesticides on industrial and private farms across the country. The Trump administration is looking to give the thumbs up to a total of 5 PFAS pesticides before the year is out. That could spell trouble. Eric Olson, pesticide expert, senior attorney at the National Resources Defense Council, explains that these chemicals can be exquisitely toxic at very low doses, parts per quadrillion or parts per trillion. In June, President Trump appointed Kyle Kunkler, a former high-ranking lobbyist in the soybean industry, to the EPA, along with former directors of the American Chemistry Council, a powerful trade group. Within a month of Kunkler's taking charge, the EPA sought to lift restrictions on a problematic herbicide that had a nasty habit of drifting on to neighboring farms and killing their crops. Quote, the pesticide office of the EPA is now being run by the chemical industry. There are limited steps consumers worried about what's in their food can take to avoid PFAS. Choosing organic fruits and vegetables can certainly help, but it's not a panacea, since PAFAs have seeped into soil and streamed into the water supply and are readily taken up by growing crops. The same is true if you choose to plant your own backyard garden. A study out of North Carolina State University found that PAFAs were particularly high in water-rich fruits like watermelon and tomatoes. Short of having your food lab tested, there's no way to tell what toxins you're consuming. According to the EPA, children are especially vulnerable because they drink more water, breathe more air, and eat more food per pound of body weight than adults. Breast milk can also carry PAFAs and pass them along to the nursing babies. Last year, the Center for Biological Diversity published a paper that sought to quantify the chemical load sprayed on crops in the United States and came up with an astonishing 30 million pounds annually. Quote, "It's not you or I who are going to be paying the price. It's our kids and their kids that are going to be saddled with pollution that never goes away. And that is the ultimate sin."
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's supposed to be really hot down south and difficult to get the chilling hours that some fruits require. Obviously, that's not the case this season, but we're going to tell you in general how to grow theoretically high chill crops like raspberries in the deep south. You won't want to miss it, and you won't if you stay tuned to the following phone call at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Amanda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Amanda. How are you?
I'm doing so good. I'm so excited.
Very good. I'm excited to have you. Where are you excited?
So I'm currently in Smithville, but my questions are about Northfield, which are basically the same area anyway.
What state?
New Jersey.
Oh, okay. You know, we
you
get
didn't
calls.
Know that, Mike?
No. Let's see. What'd you say? Stickville and what?
Smithville, Northfield, New Jersey.
Northfield, I should have known. But there's probably a Northfield in 38 different states.
Mm.
All right, let's cut to the chase. What can we do you for?
Okay, so I am engaged, and I want to get married.
Congratulations.
Thank you, thank you. So we want to get married May 1st, 2027.
Good.
So we have a little over a year from now to get ready. Now, I have become a very pollinator-friendly organic gardener.
Good.
And I would really love to have that as part of my wedding. It's going to be in my mom's backyard in Northfield.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a lot of leeway with like setting up before the ceremony, and I would love to grow everything beforehand. I wanted to plant some bulbs in the fall to come up in the spring. But my big question to you was, I want to have a wedding arch with growing ivy. Now, of course, you know, there's a billion pictures online of people using the plastic ivy and whatnot, and I love the look of wisteria. I do know that it can be very problematic, though. But isn't it gorgeous? But like on a wedding arch? But I don't know what on earth we could potentially have start growing in May and cover a wedding arch and look good by, or that we could have looking good by May 1st.
Even though the plants you mention are known for their vigor and invasiveness, you're not going to get that coverage for a couple of years or so. Right. So is this arch purchased? Is it there? Does it exist?
Not yet. But, you know, that's if we're going to start growing on it, it would have to be a soon to thing.
No. You're not going to grow on it. You're okay. going to get an specially designed arch that has places for pots, for small containers. And okay. you are going to, this fall, buy a couple of flats of pansies.
Mm-hmm.
Pansies, you know, I don't know how the name became something about a weak person, because they're the strongest flower that is. If we have a mild winter this coming winter, which we're all praying for, a lot of your pansies will survive over winter and be in really full flower by May. But this is also the time for you to talk to local garden centers and let them know that you want to order X number of flats of pansies, and then, you know, to augment whatever you have, or if whatever you have doesn't make it over the winter, you should pot those up in everything the same, so to speak, similar, like in this situation, I would even go with clay pots because they look so nice, although you'll have to keep them watered, although that's not a problem really in the springtime generally. And no matter what you do, pansies will not survive the summer. They are killed off by summer heat, but they are a totally underused fall plant. And I don't even see them being used as much as they should in the spring. Now, are you going to plant the bulbs in the ground or in containers?
So I was going to line the fence on the inside of the backyard in the ground with the bulbs was my thought.
Okay. Now, I'm going to recommend you do nothing but tulips. Just tulips from one end to the other. They are early bloomers. You can find some really neat, quote, petite varieties. But I think for your needs, you want tall ones. You want dramatic ones. And
I've seen some real pretty ones at that flower show every year in March.
Yep. And you will, obviously, you'll plant them between Halloween and Thanksgiving. So you don't plant them too early. They just need a good 30 days to get their roots established before a freeze. And then they should come up and be in bloom in a perfect time. And my advice here is buy more than you think is possible. Once you get up to buying 50 and 100 bulbs at a time, the price comes down and the wow factor goes completely up. So overplant like mad. Daffodils don't mind to be crowded. And unlike tulips and other spring bulbs, they are not eaten by moles. Moles don't eat plants. They're not eaten by voles and mice and rats and deer and evil squirrels. Nothing bothers tulips because they're toxic. Nothing bothers
daffodils.
Thank you. Somebody here has to have a brain. You carry it for now. Daffodils are toxic. Nothing bothers them. They're foolproof. And when you're planning a wedding, you want foolproof. You don't want to risk anything. You don't want to go like super crazy, and especially zero risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you can buy a really nice arch out there that has, you know, holders already for a certain type of clay pot. So you get one of those, you buy the pots, and you don't leave the pansies in those pots over the winter. Any pansies you hope to overwinter should be planted in a sunny spot in the ground and then dug up in, like, say, mid-March and planted in the pots. But you also want to have a fresh supply. You can never have too many pansies. Hopefully it will be an outdoor wedding, but there's going to be tables outside and everything.
Uh-huh.
Don't forget, I can't figure out how to talk anymore. Go big on the pansies. Buy lots of flats, buy lots of pots, and put them on the tables, and maybe everybody gets like a little save this coupon under their plate, and one of the people gets to take home the pansies and remind mm-hmm. them that they're going to bloom all spring long.
Well, one of my ideas is to have the centerpiece actually be like a little butterfly garden. So I wanted to have even a milkweed in there.
I think you're overreaching.
And then have, yeah.
I think you're overreaching, and there's not going to be any butterflies out. Butterflies are high temperature creatures.
Yeah.
They don't come out until it's like really hot outside. So, you know, it's nice that you love pollinators, but, you know, we're taking zero risk here. You want this to work.
Because pansies are a little bit prettier than milkweeds.
Oh, God, yes. No, pansies are gorgeous. And again, like the daffodils, the more of them, the better. And see, you got a whole plan. It's all set out. And now you have to worry about the menu.
Yeah, I like that idea. I didn't even think of the arch with like pots, like a place to put pots, like I guess all along the arch.
Yeah, well, no, I'm thinking they have the ones I've seen have little cup holders all up and down the side.
Gotcha. Because that's one of my main things is I wanted to have the greenery all around the arch.
Well, there's only so much you can do at that time of year. You got to be realistic. And again, when you're out shopping for this arch, buy the one with the most holders and, you know, fill the pots with the most pansies. It's going to look fabulous.
I can't wait.
You're not going to get a vine. You're not going to get butterflies, but you're going to get a beautiful floral display.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. I'm so excited.
Oh, I'm excited for you, too. All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there what aims to start their own plants from seed that you should plan to wait until 8 weeks before your last average frost date. Do not rush tender tropical plants into the garden too early or they will be surly or just plain dead the entire season. But don't go changing your planting plans just yet, because we'll be right back with Titanic Potato Tales and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, well, this made a lot more sense when I wrote it, but it's supposed to be really hot down south and difficult to get the chilling hours that some fruits require. Obviously, that's not the case this season, but we're going to tell you in general how to grow theoretically high chill crops like raspberries in the deep south. But now it is time to bring along one of our favorite guests, Jim Gerritsen, founder of Wood Prairie Farm, premier potato growers, and more. And Jim, you're going to tell us about a new variety that growers are raving about, right?
Right. Mike, how have you been?
I'm hanging in there, Jim. Getting old is not for the timid.
At our age, that's the best you can hope for, isn't it?
Yeah. So tell us about what's special about this new potato from France called Charlotte.
Well, interestingly enough, our friend Elliot Coleman is the one who got us interested in French Charlotte. Elliot had been growing this for many years, and he found that it was a variety that not only tasted good, but it grew well under the organic conditions that he has really pioneered over the last 50 years. So it took a while for him to convince us, but we're really glad that he did. It's a wonderful tasting potato. In fact, we just pre-graded that a week or two ago, and Megan has been baking Charlotte, and we've been enjoying that. Really, it's a simple meal in itself with either butter or ranch dressing, and they're very nice tasting potatoes. They have a golden flesh. They're elongated, and they grow well in the field. They're not too awful late. I'd call them a mid-late variety, but it's great. And if anyone has taken to watching YouTube videos from Europe, it's a favorite variety over there, and we've seen it many times now. YouTube channel, gardening channels feature it because it's so popular.
You know, one of the things that led me to call you about this specific variety that you're introducing, because you send out emails every week about what's happening on the farm and new varieties, I had stumbled across a whole bunch of interesting stories about the history of the potato in France, which is almost parallel to the history of the tomato in America. But it really occurs to me, should people, and of course you're going to say yes, so I'm going to say yes in advance, people really should be thinking about varieties of potatoes to plant the same way they do about tomatoes.
Absolutely. It's a funny thing. You go into the grocery store and you find, you know, what are marketed as russets and reds and yellows. The fact is, you know, among those russets, it used to be the russets from Idaho would be the variety Russet Burbank. But then Jorgensen, a plant breeder in North Dakota, came up with the variety Russet Norcota probably 30 years ago. And that made entry into the market, and it's a beautiful-looking potato, but it doesn't taste good. It kind of the flesh darkens up when you boil it. But, you know, farmers are paid by appearance and pack out, so they love it as a variety. But the interesting thing to me is that Idaho had kind of tied up its position as the potato producer using that wonderful old variety from the 1800s, Russet Burbank, and Russet Norcota was kind of the foot in the door for producers in other states like Maine, that used to be a big potato producer, to regain part of the market share that they've lost to Idaho.
But this is just such a microcosm of business getting a hold of something and making it shippable, or it looks great, or this or that, but it doesn't taste good. And
right.
I think that's why there's so many of us. There's so many small market gardeners like Elliot, who's the king of the hill there. I mean, his Four Season Farm in Maine is legendary. And if you want to grow for flavor, you pretty much have to grow your own. Because when I started with organic gardening back in 1990, that was one of the catchphrases, is the stuff that was coming in to the supermarket was bred to have longer staying power on the shelf and look brighter or something like that. But if you wanted to grow for taste, you really had to start your own garden.
That's right. The interesting thing, the few of us that are now raising organic seed and selling to market gardeners that then go to the local farmers market and provide, you know, produce, including potatoes, they now have access to some of these great tasting potatoes. So you're right. The vast majority of gardeners are going to gain access to this by growing it in their own garden. But now in the last three decades, there's been more and more specialty potatoes and other things that are available at the farmers market, grown by their local family farmers in their area, that, you know, they're rejecting the big food system, which has, you know, tomatoes like Trucker's Delight tomatoes.
Yeah, right.
Which does not promise a great eating experience. The interesting thing to me is that there is as much variation among potatoes as there is tomatoes. So the great thing is you can choose to grow great varieties of potatoes and tomatoes in your garden that otherwise, as you say, it's virtually impossible to get.
I think people should go to your website, which is Wood Prairie Farm, and or order your catalog just to be blown away by the colors and descriptions. I mean, it's not just potatoes that are red on the outside and buttery gold on the inside, but each potato has a specific purpose. I know russets still are grown largely for French fry production. And what you tell me now about these people trying to nudge Idaho away, maybe that's why French fries don't taste that good in restaurants anymore.
Well, you know, with French fries, a big part of the French fry is the oil that they're cooked in. I remember when the GMO potatoes had been introduced to the market nationwide in the mid-1990s, we had a debate here at the local college, and one proponent was advocating that GMO potatoes are a good thing, and the other was advocating that we don't know enough about them. And a reporter came up to me afterwards, a local reporter that knew that I was a local organic potato farmer, and she asked me what I thought about the debate. And I said, well, there are two things. One, both sides in the debate agreed that they should be labeling GMO crops so consumers have a right to know. And two, if I were you, I'd call up McCain's French fries tomorrow and ask them what kind of oil are they using for their potatoes, because I assumed it was canola oil, which was one of the GMO crops. So potatoes get the attention, but the oil that it's cooked in, you know, canola oil, the processors like it because it's inexpensive, but in terms of quality and health qualities, I think it's not a very good oil. So I think that's part of the reason, you know, peanut oil or other alternatives are far preferred. And I think big corporations make decisions based on cost effectiveness, and that doesn't necessarily bring out quality. Whereas small farmers, family farmers, they're looking for quality because they know that their customer base, that's what they're after. If you want low quality, you can go to the grocery store, get low quality and low prices. If you want good quality, nutrient-dense food, you either grow it in your garden or you go to a farmer's market and buy it from a local organic family farmer.
That's right, where you can see the face of the farmer. I should point out that luckily that potato was a dud. It never really made it commercially, but you bring up a good point again. Almost all of the corn, soybeans, and canola, aka rapeseed, is genetically engineered today. And it really is hard to find clean corn and clean soybeans and clean oils. It's gotten much worse since I was the editor of Organic Gardening. But there are people like you and Burpee and Renee Shepherd, all of these people, Johnny's, who are growing not only just for flavor, but flavor is out there. You know, sometimes if you're growing a crop in a tough climate, you got to sacrifice a little something for cold hardiness or something like that. But definitely if you grow your own, the only difference you're going to notice is the vast improvement.
Yeah, that's right. And when it comes to potatoes, we've always had two criteria as to what we're going to grow when it comes to a new variety. One, it has to taste good. If it doesn't taste good, somebody else can grow it. We're not interested. And the other thing, it needs to be suited to organic management, to organic farming or gardening. And, you know, a lot of modern varieties are really pampered, and they're kind of addicted to chemical inputs. I don't have any interest in growing that. What I want are workhorse varieties that taste good and do well under conditions that people are going to find in their backyard garden, ones with natural resistance. We even have some varieties that are resistant to insects because they have hairy leaves. The variety I'm talking about is called King Harry, and the reference to Harry is that these very tiny leaves, hairs on the leaves, repel the big three insects here in the east, Colorado potato beetle, potato flea beetle, and potato leafhopper. It annoys them to the point that they won't feed on that plant. So it was bred at Cornell, and we had grown its predecessor, Prince Harry, which was a higher-yielding variety, but it had a, you know, there was a correlation between the glycoalkaloid content and its ability to repel insects. And Cornell eventually came to conclude that there was too much glycoalkaloid content in the Prince Harry, so they pulled that from the market and they introduced the variety that came to be called King Harry as kind of the ultimate expression of this insect resistance. And the way they went about this, they used traditional breeding. They took some wild relatives of potatoes growing wild in Mexico, and they crossbred that against some of the round white varieties that we grow in the Northeast. And they came up with this King Harry after thousands of matches. And it's a wonderful variety in terms of growing. It's a big producer, big, lush plants, high yields every year, very reliable.
And the great thing about specialty growers like you is you pay attention down to the last detail. So people like me who just like to put stuff in the ground and get stuff back out again don't have to worry about that. The quality is assured, the safety, the tastiness. In your catalog, on your website, how many different varieties of potatoes do you have for sale?
We have 25 for sale this winter, and we always have two or three or four in the pipeline that we're conducting experiments on, and they're ones that if they pass in our trialing, we will add them in the future. But this year, we're offering 25.
How long did it take you to be comfortable bringing Charlotte to market and get the numbers up?
Charlotte came with such a strong recommendation from Elliot that cut a couple of years off. But we typically are going to grow something for 3 or 4 years before we make a final judgment. every gardener knows this. Every growing year is different. And if you base it on just one year, you're not going to have enough information. But because Elliot had grown it for 20 or 30 years and vouched for its authenticity as a great variety to grow organically, and we knew its taste by reputation, so it was a relatively easy one. You know, when we have learned, when Elliot Coleman gives you a recommendation, take it to the bank.
Absolutely. Elliot's seal of good housekeeping. Now, do you introduce a new variety every year, or because of the time-consuming process, are there years in between?
Yeah, we try to do it every year, and then occasionally Mother Nature gets in the way, and we might one year have a smaller crop than we anticipated, so we've got to hold it back. But our goal is to introduce one variety per year.
And again, I urge people who think of potatoes as white, red, or gold to look at the diversity. And a lot of these are heirloom potatoes that have been grown out by families and small farmers for generations because they taste good. I never want to lose sight. That's the duality of organic gardening. Yes, we're having a very safe garden. We're not using any toxins. We're improving the topsoil instead of eroding it. But we're also getting to choose. You know, you think you get to choose in the supermarket, but you don't really. There's like one or two types of ripe red bell peppers, and that's it. And three potatoes. So you got 25 potatoes, and the mixing and matching of the colors and flavors. People out there who love baked potatoes, who love making their own home fries or stuff like that, you'll teach them what potato to grow.
Yes. You know, when we got into this mail order seed business almost 40 years ago, we looked around and you would see like russet potatoes. Well, at that time, it was russet Burbank if they were from Idaho, but you had red potatoes. Well, red potatoes can be anything from a red Lesotho to a Pontiac to a dark red Norland, and we have a variety Red Cloud that's very dry. Red potato, you know, most people assume a red potato is going to be moist, low solids, and that's the case. But the point is, you don't see an apple in the supermarket being marketed as a red apple or a yellow apple or a green apple. They're marketed by variety. And at the same time, we're told that in Europe, the varieties are heralded, and they are marked. The potatoes in the grocery stores are marketed by variety. Yet here in the United States, where it's a big volume deal, they want to market as a round white or something generic. And we thought there must be a market here for gardeners that want to grow good tasting potatoes that perform well organically in their garden, and they want to pick it by variety name. So that really has been the shot in the arm for our business, is that, you know, people do want to grow tasty vegetables like what you're saying, and it has to be by variety. There's such a variation. You know, two varieties may look alike, but you may have a high gravity potato that would be high solids, high gravity, that if you made mashed potatoes out of it, they would be light and fluffy. But then a similar looking potato from the outside looked the same, and it would be a low solids potato that would be much better for, say, putting into soup or stew, to where the potato would hold its shape because of the solids and the type of the starch that are in it. But you can't tell by looking at it. So really, to do it right, you've got to market by variety. And in the grocery stores, it amazes me that 40 years later, I think Yukon Gold is the only potato that I can think of that, you know, broke the barrier, and they started to market that by variety name. Everything else is still being called a red or a yellow or a round white or a russet. And only Yukon Gold is breaking that mold of being marketed by variety. And now, even though the bag says Yukon Gold, in my experience, it's very likely that they aren't Yukon Gold, that they're putting in another variety and just using the Yukon Gold name as kind of like Kleenex for tissue.
Right. It becomes generic over time. Well, Jim, it's always fascinating talking with you. Again, if you're a backyard gardener, and especially if you have not really experienced the joy of growing your own potatoes, because you can buy a pretty good tomato at a farmer's market, but if you want to taste a brilliantly bred fresh tomato out of the ground, you have to grow it. And I want them to look at your catalog and your website, Wood Prairie Farm, and figure out something new, something exciting that they want to grow.
Yeah, we look at it the same way. We've been sustained by loyal customers over these many years. We even have some customers now that are the children, and their parents used to buy seed from us 30 years ago. And now that their offspring are old enough to marry and have a house and have a garden in the back, they're buying from us. And it's that kind of loyalty that has kept us in business and really has allowed Megan and me to hand down the farm to our sons, Peter and Caleb, that are now taking over. You know, we'll be a ready supply of potatoes 52 weeks a year for generations to come.
And I wish you the best. But for now, we got to say goodbye.
Thanks, Mike. Always good talking to you.
Same thing here, Jim.
Thank Bye-bye. You. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and sadly confirm that the most famous groundhog in Pennsylvania did see his shadow when he was pulled out of a nice warm den by suspicious-looking men in top hats back on the second, which theoretically means 6 more weeks of a winter that seems to have already gone on for about 3 years. But don't go taking solace in the fact that this wicked woodchuck has been wrong over half the time, because we'll be right back with tall tales about French potatoes and how to plant raspberries in warm weather climes. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Is mushroom soil good or bad for your garden? Well, it depends. What kind of mushroom soil are we talking about? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the many faces of mushroom soil. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you what's needed to grow raspberries in areas that are thought to be too warm to grow raspberries. But first, as promised, my treatise on the history of potatoes in France. Or are they really French fries? The first part of this article is from the wonderful-to-read Cooking with Class website, a small business in Paris that runs French cooking classes and culinary tours. The author is Eric Fredot. For us raised in rural France, he says, potatoes have been a long time principal ingredient of our diet and a huge source of comfort food. But it was not always so. We have one man to thank for the success of the pomme de terre, and that man's name is Antoine Augustin Parmentier. Potatoes were brought to France from Peru before the French Revolution. At first, potatoes were not at all accepted by the people. They barely gave them to pigs to eat. It had also been forbidden to cultivate the potato in France until Parlementaire convinced the Paris Faculty of Medicine to declare the potato edible in 1772, shortly before the American Revolution began. But people still resisted eating them, despite growing famines throughout France. So Parmentier started pulling some publicity stunts to try and get people to accept the potato. One brilliant idea was to post guards outside his garden, pretending that the potatoes inside were very valuable, and then instruct the guards to accept any bribes from civilians and let them steal some potatoes. Parmentier received an award in 1772 for presenting the potatoes as food capable of replacing bread in case of bad wheat harvest. But it was only in 1793, after their revolution, that the new French government decided to promote the potato. And in 1794, the first cookbook written by a woman, Madame Mergiot, was all about potato recipes. We continue to honor Parmentier for his efforts even today. Ira continues, "Well, I'm sure that you know that French fries are not French. They're probably Polish. The average French person does eat about 100 pounds of potatoes a year." We move on to a link I found to a National Geographic article written by Rebecca Rupp. Quote, "The French fry, although indisputably a fry, may not actually be French. Some claim that fries originated in Belgium, where villagers along the river Meuse traditionally ate fried fish. But in winter, when the river froze, the fish deprived villagers fried potatoes instead. It's said that this dish was discovered by American soldiers in Belgium during World War I. And since the dominant language of southern Belgium is French, they dubbed the tasty potatoes French fries. Alternately, French fries maybe really were French, first sold by street vendors on Paris's famous Pont Neuf Bridge in the 1780s. Or they might even be Spanish, since the Spaniards, after all, were the first Europeans to encounter the South American potato. The Incan potatoes may very well have been served fried. Frying in oil was a Spanish culinary tradition. Thomas Jefferson, possibly the first American foodie, is generally credited with introducing the French fry to America, and in this case, the fries were definitely French, Jefferson having encountered them while serving as American minister to France from 1784 to 1789. And about 150 recipes that he collected at the time have survived. Among these are such current all-American favorites as vanilla ice cream, macaroni and cheese, and fried potatoes. The Jeffersonian fry recipe survives in Mary Randolph's The Virginia Housewife, 1824, which indicates that the, quote, small cuttings weren't shaped like the familiar fry of today, but were instead either flat rounds or curlicues. Despite Jefferson's backing, French fries didn't seem to have caught on with the general public until the 1870s and only truly became popular in the 1900s. According to linguist Stuart Berg Flexner, they were known formally as French fried potatoes until the late 1920s. The name was subsequently shortened first to French fries and then finally in the 60s to just plain fries, as in the famous query, "You want fries with that?" As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling How Far South Can you grow raspberries? John says, I'm trying to keep my blackberry and raspberry vines healthy in a winter that goes from 30s one day to near 80. I asked John exactly where that might be, and he responded, I'm in the Arc Latex, which I later learned was the area where Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas crashed together. Then he adds, if I read the maps correctly, it's USDA Zone 8B. Oh, and my plants are in pots. Well, this could be a very short answer now. You can't grow cane fruits like raspberries in pots because the roots need to spread out far and wide for their life cycle to continue. Now, you can grow blueberries in a pot because they're shrubs that do not spread. But with raspberries, the more room you give them, the more berries you'll get, no matter your climb. Now, to actually answer your specific question, you can grow raspberries in a warm climate if you grow them in a specific area and you cheat a bit. And remember, kids, like I always tell you, cheaters always win. Raspberries require a certain number of, quote, chilling hours to bear fruit. That means nights in the mid to low 40s or colder. The, quote, book says that the most basic types can only be grown as far south as USDA Zone 6. But I know of patches that thrive in Zone 7 and 8. The trick is to plant a designated low-chill variety in a spot that gets morning sun and afternoon shade. Yeah. I say morning sun and afternoon shade for just about every plant. I know it. But the further south you are, the more universal that advice becomes, except for dogwoods, where the need for afternoon shade always applies. Anywho, in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, Midwest, and other cold winter regions, raspberries should get full sun. So should crops like tomatoes and peppers. But when you get to areas where winter is mostly mild and summers can get intensely hot, those same plants need a break late in the day. As I have often explained, quote, full sun in a catalog description means full sun in the north, a little shade in USDA Zone 7, and serious afternoon shade in the higher zones. It's easy to forget that catalog and online descriptions have to try and cover the entire country, when in reality, plants are going to have very different needs in Minnesota than they do in San Diego, where, by the way, raspberries are difficult to impossible to grow. All right, when do we plant our raspberries? In the spring. You buy dormant canes mail order or from a local nursery and garden center and plant them in the ground about the same time as your tomatoes. If you know someone who's already growing raspberries nearby, see if you can bum a few plants from them in the spring when lots of new shoots will pop up in established patches. These canes should already be adapted to your local climate. At the very least, see if they know the variety name that they're growing and seek to purchase the same plants. Quote unquote bare root canes will arrive brown and dry. Get them ready for planting by soaking them in a bucket of clean water, not tap water, for at least 8 hours and as much as 24. Use a brick to hold them under the water so they get good and saturated. If the canes are fresh and green, they just need to be watered in well when you plant them. There are two basic types of red raspberries. The most common are known as fall bearing, which is half ripe. and ever-bearing, which is technically correct, kind of. I grow, quote, fall-bearing varieties, which actually fruit twice a year. Their growing sequence is highly unusual. New canes sprout up from the soil in the spring. They grow long and tall all season long and then produce a nice crop of berries at the very tips of the canes in the fall. Then those canes go dormant for the winter and may look dead, but don't dare prune them out because the following year they will sprout new green growth and produce a big flush of berries all up and down those canes just as summer arrives. I never have enough raspberries to share in the fall, but I give away pints when that second year late spring harvest comes in. It's a ratio of almost 10 to 1. That so-called second crop is truly enormous. So don't do anything to your first year canes except deadhead them by pruning off the very tips when the fruits are finished or frosted. The other basic type of raspberry is ever-bearing, sometimes called summer bearers. They pretty much fruit all season long. Consult your local county extension service when choosing varieties. They know which ones should do best in your area. Unfortunately, some extension services are not the best when it comes to what we call cultural care, as many continue to recommend high-potency chemical salts as fertilizers, which is especially crazy because raspberries do best in very poor soil with little to no added nutrition, plus watering while they're getting established. If you foolishly use chemical fertilizers, you'll get insects, disease, and inferior fruit. What raspberries need most is room to spread. They are not well-behaved plants, and the best patches are planted with room to roam. They also need superior drainage, especially in climes that typically get a lot of rain. They will need extra water during drought, and that afternoon shade is essential in those warmer zones. And it isn't all that hard to provide. Set up some big hoop house structures and pull shade cloth over them. Shade cloth is easy to find and comes in different levels of shadiness. Or use beach umbrellas or patio umbrellas. Just do not let those plants go without afternoon shade, or move north. That sure was a lot of good raspberry growing advice, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure, or of course your leisure, by following the link for the Gardens Alive Question of the Week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to ransack my raspberries if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime. Yes, you can. 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And if you happen to live anywhere, please tell us where it is. And visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and invite you to send us photos of your precious plants, share your thoughts about the show, receive important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when Betty and Barney Hill gave him the keys to their car. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprot. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And I'm dodging colds, the flu, and COVID. Not to mention snowstorms, ice storms, and Sue storms. But I grabbed the ultimate nullifier in time to be sure to see you again next week.